Hello, and welcome to this podcast focusing on new frontiers in the treatment of ovarian cancer. In this episode, which features excerpts from a recent educational symposium, Drs. Rachel Grisham, Ramez Iskander, and Oladapo Yeku provide practical guidance on integrating emerging therapies and evidence-based strategies to personalize care and improve outcomes for patients with ovarian cancer. This activity is provided by PER and supported by educational grants from AbbVie Incorporated and Corcept Therapeutics Incorporated. Let's begin by discussing the importance of biomarker testing in newly diagnosed ovarian cancer. Rosa, a 49-year-old with stage 3C high-grade serous disease, underwent complete gross resection. Understanding her biomarker results is now critical to shaping her treatment plan.
We're going to start our discussion tonight with a case of a patient named Rosa. And throughout tonight's discussion, we're going to follow her through different courses of her treatment. So Rosa is a 49-year-old woman who recently presented to a gynecologist after having several months of abdominal bloating and pain previously evaluated by her primary care physician and a GI doctor. At that time, she had a CT performed that showed bilateral adnexal masses and pelvic ascites, and her CA125 was found to be elevated at 1600. She underwent a primary debulking surgery, which resulted in a complete gross resection of her disease. And her pathology was consistent with stage 3C high-grade serous ovarian cancer. So Dr. Iskander, for a patient like this who's just been diagnosed with high-grade serous ovarian cancer, who you're meeting in clinic for the first time, what additional testing do you request to be done on her tissue or her blood?
In our clinical practice and the way I manage these patients is universal germline genetic testing. And then also in these ovarian cancer patients, the vast majority of whom are advanced age at the time of surgical intervention or diagnosis, we do also perform molecular testing on the tumor. And I think it's really important because in this case, there was a primary surgical cytoreduction, but many of these patients are also managed with neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And if it's just ascites for diagnosis, you don't have tissue to facilitate molecular testing. And that can sometimes impact your ability to make a decision down the line in their treatment paradigm. But here we send that institutionally, our pathologists are doing FR alpha in-house on the surgical specimen, and they're also doing HER2 in certain clinical circumstances. We don't do MMR IHC in these patients reflexively at our institution at this time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And that's such an important point that in order to do so many of these tests, you need tumor tissue. And so if you just have cytology or an FNA, sometimes that's inadequate.
What genetic and molecular tests should be performed in newly diagnosed ovarian cancer? And how do these results shape the treatment approach from the outset?
We typically start with germline BRCA testing. We also look for somatic BRCA testing, but that comes later on because just of the way molecular pathology is set up in my institution, HRD testing, somatic BRCA testing, that happens on a separate panel. So our patients are often referred to clinical genetics for the germline right at the beginning, really right as they're starting chemotherapy. We make a determination of their BRCA status first. If they're BRCA mutant, we kind of stop there. We have enough data to determine maintenance therapy and future plans. If they're BRCA wild type, then they continue down the diagnostic pathway, which then involves somatic BRCA testing, homologous repair deficiency testing. We do not do folate receptor testing because we don't have it on the same panel. So we do that at the time of recurrence. And every now and then, our pathologists, whenever we see certain histological subtypes like clear cell, they would routinely check MMR. Mm-hmm. But that's just a pathology decision to conserve resources.
When in the treatment timeline should HRD testing be performed, and how quickly do clinicians aim to have those results available to guide decision making?
I'd like to get the data as soon as I can in the treatment paradigm, mostly because in clinical practice and experience, we see that if it's not done early on, sometimes it can be overlooked because the patient's treatment has started, the initiation of therapy doesn't, you know, for whatever reason, gets overlooked. And also, this relates back to the prior comment where if it's cytology-based, there are clinical circumstances where at the time of surgical cytoreduction, there's insufficient viable tumor to facilitate HRD or alternate molecular testing assessment. And that's why it's so important in my mind to get it done soon so that you have the information.
For me, mentally, I like to get all the data by the fifth cycle. And not because that's when it's possible, but it reminds me to keep checking. And this allows for our patients who also undergo neoadjuvant chemotherapy, because that's when their tissue is back, either after the third cycle or fourth cycle.
Yeah, no, I think it's such a good point, because oftentimes our patients are being seen by nurse practitioners for certain cycles. We're not seeing them every cycle. And so I similarly try to keep a checklist in my note of, do I have the germline results? Do I have the somatic results? Do I have the HRD results? And where am I on my IHC results? Because there's a lot for us to keep track of now, which is good. But we got to make sure we're staying on top of all those things for sure. So really across the guidelines, ASCO, ESMO, NCCN, and SGO, it is recommended that all of our patients with newly diagnosed ovarian cancer have, at a minimum, germline and somatic testing done. And then it's also recommended that those patients who are not known to have a BRCA mutation also have HRD testing performed. Since this is, of course, so important for us making our subsequent treatment decisions, and also in terms of germline testing for informing family members. And I think it's important to note that these guidelines are regardless of histology. So of course, most of our patients with a BRCA mutation will have high-grade serous ovarian cancer, but all of our patients with ovarian cancer, regardless of histology, have a right to have genetic testing performed and should routinely be done for all of our patients. And now we have more options also available for IHC testing, as was mentioned. And in some practices, this is done upfront as part of the initial panel. In other practices, it's reserved for the recurrent setting. And in part, that can depend on logistical issues, such as whether it's being done internally or as part of an external send-out panel. But the most important thing is that patients have this information when they need it. So I think oftentimes, logistically, we work through our own workflows to find the best way that will allow our patients to have the most comprehensive information possible about their cancer, including their germline and somatic results, their HRD results, and then also these major IHC markers. So of course, now we know that about 30 to 40% of our patients will have high level of folate receptor alpha, which is important for treatment in the recurrent setting. And then a significant proportion of other patients will have moderate level of folate receptor alpha. And then HER2 testing just recently became an option across all solid tumors. And while 3+ IHC is relatively rare in ovarian cancer, up to 18% of our patients with ovarian cancer will have 2+ expression by IHC. And so very important that we have this information about our patients to see if they have additional potential therapeutic options in the recurrent setting. And then MMR. So MMR deficiency, of course, is relatively rare in high-grade serous ovarian cancer, but we do see it more commonly in our endometriosis-associated cancers and mucinous cancer. So we don't want to forget to look for that for our patients as well. So I would say, in general, we recommend that all of our patients have germline and somatic testing at time of diagnosis, HRD testing if they don't have a known BRCA mutation, and then consideration for additional IHC testing at time of initial diagnosis, and if not done at time of initial diagnosis, then at time of recurrence.
For those patients that did not have IHC testing done, are there any additional tests that you do at time of recurrence? Or would it mostly be these same ones?
I would do the same ones, particularly because folate receptor alpha positivity and HER2 positivity are actionable. Mm-hmm. For patients who are considering clinical trials, there's an opportunity to redo some of these because they're bundled in with other panels. So sometimes we'll get additional results, but that's really mostly for patients who are thinking about experimental therapy.
What's your general strategy for discussing why these biomarkers are important and how they're going to impact patients' care?
My personal approach, this can be a bit overwhelming depending on the patient, depending on their diagnosis, but I do think that repetition is really important. So I actually like to have these conversations early, and as we're going through the therapeutic paradigm for that particular patient, we revisit these issues as they come up. We revisit as the results come back, and I learn more about their disease, and I understand, and we make decisions about how we're going to transition care.
Certainly not on the first day at the beginning of chemotherapy, but certainly for my patients who unfortunately have stage 4 disease, where we know that the risk of progression or recurrence is fairly high, we start to have those discussions right around the time that we're transitioning to maintenance therapy.
One key finding in Rosa's case is homologous recombination deficiency. But what does that mean for patients? And how can we explain it in a way that's easy to understand? Here's how the concept is typically introduced in clinical discussions.
So I tell patients that, you know, all of our cells have different backup machinery for how they repair damage. And that's how they keep themselves going, almost like a tire patch. You can slap it on different places, keep the tire rolling, keep the air in the wheels. However, in some of these cancer cells, some of those proteins are missing. And when that happens, naturally, our body has ways of deleting or removing cells that are unable to repair themselves after sustained damage. So what we're trying to do is to capitalize on the absence of these fixers to push these tumor cells all the way into that catastrophic deletion. So we can utilize, and I often will use the word synthetic lethality, because patients can put those two words together to say, we're trying to use two things to basically push the tumors or push the tumor cells past that point of no return because they cannot fix themselves or fix their DNA damage.
Once homologous recombination deficiency is identified, the next step is selecting the most appropriate maintenance therapy. But how is that decision made, and what factors guide the choice of treatment?
A lot of that ties into what treatment paradigm we've employed in the management of their advanced stage and or metastatic disease. So as I think about strategies such as this, many of us have to make a decision about whether or not we're going to incorporate bevacizumab with carboplatin and paclitaxel in the treatment of these patients. If I've elected to utilize bevacizumab in the treatment and my patient is homologous recombination deficient, in those clinical circumstances, I talk about maintenance therapy inclusive of bevacizumab plus a PARP inhibitor, the PAOLA-1 regimen. Conversely, if the patient was on carboplatin and paclitaxel as a therapeutic strategy and is HRD positive, then we talk about maintenance PARP inhibition. Now, of course, the conversation includes the rationale and the data and try to explain the efficacy, but also empowering the patients by explaining what side effects might emerge and how we're going to manage those side effects. Because I feel like we're able to do so for these patients because the magnitude of benefit with these drugs is substantial in the biomarker positive cohort.
For patients with an HRD positive tumor or a BRCA mutation, several maintenance strategies are available. But what about those who are homologous recombination deficient? The discussion now shifts to how treatment decisions are approached for this biomarker negative group.
Many of these patients with stage 3 or 4 disease have a high risk of recurrence. And in these patients, I will actually discuss the use of niraparib, and that is the last set of slides that I showed there, as maintenance. Initially, when we were using the higher dose of niraparib, we saw a lot of thrombocytopenia. That really had a different risk-benefit evaluation or calculation. But recently, as the trial was amended then to include a lower dose based on patients' weight and their initial platelets, it was better manageable, right? For some patients still have a tough time, but it's better manageable. So for the vast majority of my patients at a high risk of recurrence, which are the population we talked about, I really do discuss the merits of maintenance monotherapy niraparib.
When caring for patients who are homologous recombination deficient, how do clinicians decide between treatment options? What factors influence that choice?
Very relevant, because we see this frequently, and it ties into the response that I provided earlier in terms of if I'm using Bev in that patient, I will likely continue bevacizumab as a maintenance treatment strategy based on the clinical trials that we've conducted showing Bev efficacy from a PFS perspective. But it's also very important for us to remember there were FDA withdrawals for the utilization of PARP inhibitors in subsequent lines of therapy independent of a BRCA mutated patient. So the frontline maintenance may be the only opportunity for a PARP exposure. So it's having this conversation and yet balancing some of the other data that might suggest progression on PARP can impact subsequent lines of treatment. So it is very nuanced. I will say that I personally tend to use bevacizumab in my clinical practice because many of our patients do present with large volume disease and a significant burden. And we know that incorporation of bevacizumab with chemotherapy can help manage that disease burden well. So if they've been started and they're this, I call them biomarker negative patient cohort, then I will likely continue the bevacizumab. But there are certainly patients who are on carboplatin and paclitaxel without Bev. And then we have a conversation about the PARP maintenance, as Dr. Yeku clearly outlined.
Now let's bring it back to Rosa's story. A patient with stage 3C high-grade serous ovarian cancer, no BRCA mutation, but HRD positive, who completed platinum taxane with bevacizumab. Naturally, the next question she and many patients asks is, What about immunotherapy? It's a topic that comes up frequently, and it's time to explore the current data on its role in upfront treatment.
Immunotherapy had been one of those things for upfront treatment of ovarian cancer that we had all worked on so very, very hard to try to find ways to incorporate. And unfortunately, many of our trials did not meet their primary endpoint, and our bar was pretty high. We're looking for progression-free survival, we're looking for overall survival, very similar to the endpoints for the data that I previously showed, because we want to make sure that our patients are living longer without disease. That's really what those endpoints translate into in layperson language. And none of our trials had really shown that benefit satisfactorily. And, you know, it's getting quite worrisome. Up until the recent reporting of the DUO-O study, what did they do? So they looked at patients with, again, advanced disease, stage 3, stage 4, high-grade epithelial ovarian cancer, who had had no prior systemic therapy, no prior PARP, no prior immunotherapy, no prior BRCA mutation, because we already talked about our approach to patients with a deleterious BRCA mutation. And these patients could either have primary cytoreduction, which is surgery as right upon diagnosis, or interval cytoreduction after new adjuvant chemotherapy. And they were randomized 1:1:1. And if you're seeing this for the first time, it takes a couple of minutes to really orient to what's going on. So if you haven't seen this study design before, you may have to go over it a couple of times, but I'll talk a little bit slowly. In the first arm, which is the topmost one, that's the reference arm, that included platinum combination, so it's carboplatin and paclitaxel, with bevacizumab, so we've all seen this combination before, and placebo. That's the chemotherapy they got. And then in maintenance, they only got bevacizumab and two placebo. So think of it as two placebo slots that we're going to put other stuff into. So very similar to a patient getting carbo, taxol, bev, and then bev maintenance, except they got some placebo just to mask it for other folks. The middle column there is carbo, taxol, bevacizumab, so far, just like the first one, but that placebo slot is now taken over by durvalumab, which is an immune checkpoint inhibitor. So we're looking at immunotherapy incorporation with chemotherapy, and then in maintenance, they get bevacizumab plus the immunotherapy. So one of the other placebo slots from the maintenance arm, from the reference section, has now been taken up by immunotherapy. So asking the question, does bevacizumab plus immunotherapy maintenance after that combination with chemo, does it do anything for us in terms of progression-free survival? The last arm, which is the preferred investigational arm, is now looking at that middle arm, carboplatin, taxol, bevacizumab, with immunotherapy during their induction or their treatment phase. But then during the maintenance, this is where it changes now, they're now getting bevacizumab, durvalumab, which is the immune checkpoint inhibitor, plus olaparib. So the PARP inhibitor comes back from our previous discussion on incorporating PARP inhibitor maintenance. So this is really incorporating everything we have in our upfront arsenal. An anti-angiogenic in the form of bevacizumab, immune checkpoint inhibitors, which is very popular with patients, and olaparib, which is the PARP inhibitor, for which we already have established data for patients with BRCA mutations, HRD deficiency, and only for mostly for niraparib from the data, all comers. The endpoint, as I briefly alluded to, was progression-free survival in the preferred arm, which is the orange arm, depending on what color it looks like on your screen, in both patients with HRD deficient disease and in all comers. And here's the data. We found that in patients, so these patients are BRCA wild type because we have a clear pipeline for those in the SOLO-1 data that I showed you very, very first. So these are patients who have HRD proficient disease, BRCA wild type. We're really looking at the red line, that is our experimental arm, compared to the other two arms there. They're gray, they're blue, it doesn't matter. They all kind of cluster, they run together. And these are patients who received immune checkpoint inhibitors, durvalumab, with chemo, followed, and bevacizumab, followed by bevacizumab, immune inhibitor, PARP inhibitor, so maximal therapy. And those patients had a median progression-free survival of 45 months compared to about 22 and 25 months in the control arm. The reference arm there is arm one, which is in gray, so it's 23 versus 45 months, which is significant if you're a patient just looking at time, looking at all of the things you can do with that time. Again, these are medians. When we look at the intent to treat population, that median PFS now drops to 25 months in the experimental arm compared to 19 months in the reference arm, which is just chemo with bevacizumab. Shown differently, I highlighted that, made it into a table, this time looking at both the median progression-free survival, as I told you about, but also looking at the hazard ratio. And if you look in that HRD deficient arm, that's really what's driving the results that we're seeing in the intent to treat population, because over there, there is a little less than a 60% risk reduction in progression versus 40% when you look at the all comers. And this phenomenon, if you've seen this before, is because that's typically what we've seen in a lot of our all comer studies. The magnitude of benefit in the HRD or the homologous repair deficient population is so wide that it carries over or carries through when you combine it with all comers. So the conclusion is that compared to the reference arm, which is chemotherapy plus bevacizumab, the combination of chemo, bev, durvalumab during the treatment induction phase, followed by bevacizumab, durvalumab, olaparib, improved progression-free survival in the HRD deficient BRCA wild-type populations and in the intentional to treat analysis. So this data is relatively hot off the press, still being circulated. We still have to see how this will fit into our treatment paradigm. But this represents a culmination of a lot of our efforts in looking at how we can best incorporate immune checkpoint inhibitors into our first-line maintenance armamentarium. Our best results are when we put it together with bevacizumab, which has been a staple for us, and with PARP inhibitors based on the data that I've shown you, which really they've all built upon one another. The other study I wanted to talk about is the ENGOT-OV44 study, or the first trial. This, again, looked at a very similar starting population with high advanced disease and no prior systemic therapy. They were randomized 1:1:2 to look at the chemotherapy doublet and placebo, carboplatin Taxol, followed by oral placebo and IV placebo, so two placebo slots, something oral, something IV. The second row in the middle is carbotaxol placebo. This time around, they get niraparib, takes up the oral slot from above, and placebo. So a little bit similar to the PRIMA study that I showed you before, looking at niraparib maintenance for all comers. Then in the last arm, it's chemotherapy plus dostarlimab, which is a different immune checkpoint inhibitor, followed by niraparib plus immune checkpoint inhibitor. So if you notice here, this looks relatively similar to the DUO-E study that I just showed you, except the PARP inhibitor is different. And then you ask yourself, wait a minute, there was also bevacizumab in that one as well. I don't see that here. And that's because on this study, bevacizumab was allowed based on the physician discretion. So if you had a patient in front of you in the clinic whom you felt would benefit from bevacizumab, putting them on this study did not preclude you from adding bevacizumab both to the chemotherapy induction phase and or to the maintenance phase. So this was based on physician discretion. Unfortunately, or fortunately for the patients, depending on what side of the coin you look at, that first arm became irrelevant. Because if you remember, all of the data that I've shown you so far, if you wanted to incorporate PARP maintenance or bevacizumab maintenance as part of your practice, you have a good reason to do so based on high quality data. So randomizing a patient to really no maintenance, which is what that grayed out box is, because it's oral placebo and IV placebo, really raises some questions in terms of what is appropriate and what is equipoise, because those patients, many of them may be eligible for various maintenance therapies, inclusive of the ones we talked about at this meeting. So they had to continue the study, and they'd already started, so they had to amend the study and continue with both the last two arms, with the bottom arm, which looks like orange there, being the investigational arm. The results for this study were, it was announced that it met its endpoint very recently. And there's a caveat here, is that until we see the data, you know, as practitioners who are seeing patients, there's a clear difference between what we might feel is a clinical endpoint and what might be a statistical endpoint. And we really want to look at the data, scrutinize it, to really better understand, did it meet both, did it meet one or the other, and if so, by what magnitude? So everyone is very eager to see these results, and I would caution that we wait and see it in a public forum or preferably in a peer review setting for us to really, again, understand where these results alongside Duo E, how that would fit into our management based on the previous slides that I've shown you. So based on all the interest in PARP inhibitors, you know, there's a lot of questions when patients come back in and they have progression of disease on a PARP inhibitor. The way I discuss it with the synthetic lethality, they're like, well, Dr. Yeku, if you're pushing all these tumors to basically implode because they cannot repair their DNA, that should be a one-way street. So why is my tumor growing? Why did my disease come back? And unfortunately, I don't have a satisfying answer, as shown by these cartoons. When we have cartoons, it generally means we don't have a very good idea of what's going on. But we have reasonable theories that we've tested in lab, in the preclinical setting, and some of them are starting to bear fruit, but none of them so far have been clinically actionable. So we know that these tumors evolve to develop mechanisms to stabilize their DNA replication fork, so basically put the brakes on the car so they don't have to keep driving on the faulty tire. They have ways of trapping or developing other pathways so they can keep going in spite of all the damage they're taking to their DNA. They found ways to just not die as efficiently, basically suppress apoptosis. And we've also seen upregulation of just classical chemotherapy resistance pathways where they're just pumping out the drug and the cancer cells are receiving less drug. In the near future, hopefully we'll see some of these be actionable. Some of them in the form of reversion mutations, for example, are being very well characterized in the breast cancer area. There's a list, it is growing. We've looked at, then the question then becomes, are there combination therapies we can start to use? As we cook some of these in the lab and get a better understanding, are there things we can bring to the clinic to answer the now question? And here is a list of some studies that we're looking at to overcome these resistance mechanisms. This is not an exhaustive list, but it gives you an idea of some of the pathways we're looking at. I've highlighted some here. We've looked at PARP inhibitors plus WEE1 inhibitors, for example. There are questions about toxicity and combinations that are being worked out. We've looked at ATR inhibitors. These are other genes that are involved in the repair pathway. Can we cripple these tumors from both directions? That's another area of active investigation. But again, more to come. These trials are ongoing and the results are coming out, and we're learning how to incorporate them into practice as we go.
After completing chemotherapy and starting maintenance therapy, Rosa unfortunately experiences a recurrence 11 months later, marked by a rising CA-125. At this point, treatment planning becomes more complex. The conversation now turns to how clinicians navigate the key decision points in managing recurrent ovarian cancer.
And the majority of patients develop disease recurrence. And when you develop disease recurrence, you are platinum sensitive and or platinum resistant. Unfortunately, even those patients who are platinum sensitive will ultimately develop platinum resistance. And what we know is that platinum resistant recurrent ovarian cancer continues to have devastating clinical consequences because our treatment options remain limited. But recently, as you guys are very aware, we've had an explosion of discovery looking at antibody drug conjugates. So we have FR alpha, we have TROP2, we have EGFR, we have B7H4, amongst many others. So we're gonna talk about the story for mirvetuximab soravtansine. So mirvetuximab is an FR alpha directed antibody drug conjugate with a tubulin disrupting MMAE payload. The confirmatory trial, which was the Mirasol trial, which was presented and simultaneously published by the leading author, Dr. Katie Moore, this looked at the randomized confirmatory study that took these patients with platinum-resistant recurrent ovarian cancer, and you could see the number of prior lines of therapy that were permitted, randomizing them to mirvetuximab, antibody drug conjugate monotherapy at 6 mg/kg intravenously every 3 weeks versus physician's choice chemotherapy. And you could see again, that chemo arm is paclitaxel or pegylated liposomal doxorubicin or topotecan. And what we saw, and you could see on the two Kaplan-Meier curves, the top Kaplan-Meier curve showing us the PFS improvement in this patient population, and the arrow is highlighting the drop off at first assessment. So you could see that the PFS hazard ratio is significantly positive, And you could see that the efficacy appears to be early on in exposure. And then you could see, more importantly, really the first reported trial in the platinum-resistant recurrent space where we had an overall survival advantage of approximately 4 months with incorporation of mirvetuximab when compared to physician's choice single-agent chemotherapy.
While much of the recent progress has centered around antibody-drug conjugates, ADCs, it is also important to highlight a promising non-ADC approach. One such advancement targets the glucocorticoid receptor pathway, a mechanism that may interfere with chemotherapy's ability to induce tumor cell death. Relacorilant is a novel agent being explored in this space, supported by encouraging phase 3 data.
And I did want to highlight one thing that's a non-ADC advancement that we referred to as well, which is targeting the glucocorticoid receptor. So principally, what we think is signaling through the glucocorticoid receptor can result in inhibition of apoptosis, which, as you might imagine, would be decremental to our desire for cytotoxic chemotherapy to affect benefit in patients who have platinum-resistant recurrent ovarian cancer. So relacorilant is a glucocorticoid receptor antagonist trying to block that anti-apoptotic signal, drive cells to cell death, and subsequently result in an improved clinical outcome. The Rosella study was a phase 3 clinical trial that was importantly built on data from a prior phase 1 and phase 2 trial informing the use of nab-paclitaxel in combination with an intermittent dosing of relacorilant the day before, the day of, and the day after treatment with nab-paclitaxel. And these patients were platinum resistant, 1 to 3 prior lines, allowing platinum patients who progressed after 1 month. Those patients were commonly excluded because they were defined as kind of poor prognosis patients. They were allowed to enroll on this trial. And I will say that there was a press release on March 31st that this met its primary efficacy endpoint.
As Rosa's journey shows, treatment planning in ovarian cancer is more personalized than ever, guided by molecular insights, trial data, and clinical judgment. As research advances, the goal remains the same: to extend survival and improve the quality of life for every patient. Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description. To earn credit for participating in this podcast, please follow the instructions on how to receive credit information in the episode description.